Welcome to Healthcare and Hire, a podcast for healthcare professionals and aspiring healthcare executives looking for information, association, and inspiration from higher-level leaders across the healthcare industry. I'm Iqbal Acha, career consultant, healthcare recruiter, and registered pharmacist. Every week, I sit down to interview healthcare executives, clinical leaders, medical entrepreneurs, and industry experts to learn how they got to where they are today, what they see as the future of healthcare, and what they're doing to make healthcare more accessible, affordable, and effective. Let's find out more about today's guest. Dr. Rehan Wahid is the Chief Medical Informatics Officer at Quest Diagnostics. He oversees clinical expertise for their Healthcare Analytics Solutions division, while also championing important initiatives to advance analytics in public health. Dr. Wahid joined Quest Diagnostics in 2021 as a Senior Medical Director. Prior to this, he served as a director of physician executives at Cerner Corporation, leading efforts in the federal sector, and as the senior director for integration and transformation at the Metro Health System. Dr. Wahid earned his medical degree from the Northeast Ohio Medical University and is board certified in internal medicine. He has a Lean Six Sigma black belt, an informatics certificate, and continues to teach as adjunct faculty at Baldwin Wallace University. Hello, Dr. Wahid. Welcome to the Healthcare and Hire podcast.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
It's a pleasure. Rehan, we've had a couple of conversations in the past. So glad that we were able to make this happen. I know my audience is excited to hear about you, your journey, and the great things that Quest Diagnostics and your team specifically are doing. There's probably a percentage of my audience today that is meeting you for the first time. Why don't we take this opportunity and have you formally introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are, what your role is, and how do you help take healthcare to a higher level?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me here. It's truly a pleasure. Rehan Wahid, an internist by training, kind of worked in several careers, I guess, roles throughout the years. My current title is Senior Medical Director and Chief Medical Informatics Officer at Quest Diagnostics within our Healthcare Analytics Solutions Division. So currently today, I have two different hats that I wear. One, I've got responsibilities for our public health vertical within HAS. And then from a CMIO perspective, responsible for helping the other verticals with their clinical strategy and thinking through clinical approaches. So, a lot of strategy work, but also operations as well. So managing, leading, and inspiring teams to be able to do things that you hadn't really thought about being able to do before. My career has been a bit all over. I had my own tech company back in high school, so I started there. And then my mom being an immigrant was like, it really would be great if you became a doctor. So that kind of set me down the path for medicine, got into an accelerated program, but never let go of my entrepreneurial or tech background. And so continued to do some side gigs, side hustles along the way. And then as I got out into practice, I saw there was a huge opportunity in leveraging data as EMRs were becoming a thing with meaningful use, and saying, how can we make this easier and better for physicians? Because current practice today of trying to memorize everything is not really feasible. There's so much literature, so much evidence coming out on a regular basis. We really need to think about a systemic approach to things, and really starts with data. And so that kind of led me into quality improvement and really doing systems level thinking, getting into healthcare operations and understanding both front and back end of how things work. Was involved in leading a lot of the efforts within the local deployment piece for my last employer when I was working to help the VA transition into their newer EHR. So really setting up the initial foundational structures and teams, and then working in the federal sector, and joined Quest about 2 years ago, and really had an opportunity to build out what I had been dreaming about. And it's exciting to have an opportunity to work for a phenomenal general manager, David Freeman, within Quest, and looking forward to seeing more to come.
There's so many questions that I'm going to be asking of you, because I think it's remarkable when an individual such as yourself, with the caliber of information and experience, finds an opportunity to kind of blend it all together in one neat package that allows you to tap into your passions and your strengths and your ideas of creativity. So we're going to definitely delve into that. There's probably a few people on this, you know, that are listening to today's episode that may not be familiar with Quest Diagnostics. And if you've never walked into a Walmart, which is probably the last time I was, and I saw a Quest Diagnostics, I have to go back to when I was like 16 and I was actually suspected for having mono. And I had to go to a Quest Diagnostic Center to get, testing for that. But for those that are not familiar with Quest Diagnostics, it is actually ranked number 342 on the Fortune 500. It's a company that offers over 3,500 diagnostic tests that help to identify, catalog, and just do a lot of, specific categorization for different types of disease states, including cancer, cardiovascular disease, infectious disease, neurological diseases, as obviously drug testing and COVID-19 as well. But you know, what's remarkable is that your company actually operates not just in three countries, United States, Mexico, and Brazil, but you're also in Puerto Rico. You have over 48,000 employees at 2,200 plus locations across the country. And I think last year you guys tested performed over 50 million tests. These are very, very significant numbers. You are known as a juggernaut in the industry. And honestly, like the corporate social responsibility and the way that you treat your employees is very remarkable. I was taking a look at your website earlier today, and just a laundry list of awards just in the last couple of months, including the fourth consecutive year that Quest Diagnostic was identified as the best place to work for disability inclusion. You were also awarded Fortune's World Most Admired Companies, and the list goes on and on. So if you're not familiar with Quest Diagnostics, you are now, and you'll certainly be able to learn a lot more about the intricate workings of how Rehan and his team operate. So let's kind of talk a little bit about that. You've had some very interesting statements that you made at your introduction. I'd love to hear a little bit about, how you've been able to tap into your analytical mind and then being able to help Quest Diagnostics in the world that you operate today. Tell us a little bit about, your team. Tell us about your role in terms of supervising that team or guiding that team, and maybe an initiative that you've taken on very recently with some demonstrable results, or an initiative that you're working on today that you really think is going to be a game changer for others in your industry.
So I'd like to add a little bit more to the context of Quest first, and then I'll get into the question that you've asked. One of the things that I was really excited to learn about Quest as I was looking at my next opportunity when I joined is the work that the leadership team, the senior leadership team and the CEO at the time, who's currently still CEO, but will be stepping down, set aside $100 million for a Quest for Health Equity effort. So this was an opportunity where a corporation not only was saying the words, but was putting the money to the word. And that doesn't happen very often. If you look across industry, you see a lot of letters and speeches and statements, but there was dollars put. And for me, I think that's remarkable to show from a company perspective. And then joining the HAS team and having a general manager for, I would probably argue, the first time in my career, really acknowledge me as an individual, knowing both my religious and cultural practices are a bit different, and taking the time to learn them and then celebrating them. Again, just a very different culture here compared to the many other places that I've worked. And what we see is people come and they want to stay because it is as great as it is. So let me talk about my phenomenal team. It's a small team, but it is really growing at a rapid pace. We've got a few data scientists, we've got product owners, we've got interns, we've got a hodgepodge mix of individuals with diverse skill sets really coming in, really towards a common goal. And when we think about it for public health, I talk about two big elements that we're trying to tackle. One, I talk about democratization of insights. How do we make it easier for more people to understand what's happening within their communities? Right now, if I need to go and figure something out, I've got to talk to a data scientist or write some code, pull some data, clean the data, and then create some reports. And maybe by, you know, the end of the month, I'll have some information. How do I do that instantaneously at fingertips? We see that in other industries, but in healthcare, it hasn't really been at the forefront. We talk a lot about how do we document, how do we bill? But when we think about population health, there hasn't really been a ton consistently. Yes, there are some tools. Yes, there are solutions out there, but to really do it at scale, it's really challenging, mainly because the information isn't set up for that. And so there's a lot that needs to be done. Plus, you need to think about things in a collective whole person point of view. It's not just clinical, it's social determinants, the other elements that you have to factor in as you think about why things are occurring. So that's the first part, democratization of insights. The second is around distributed actions. As we know in healthcare, one individual can't fix anything, right? So I, as a physician, when I saw patients, I would, in the primary care clinic, I would say, who are the two people involved in the care of you? And most of the time the patients would be like, oh, it's you. I'm like, okay, that's one. Who else? They would go through, well, the other docs. I'm like, okay, yes, that's still part of one, right? So that health system, me, medical, okay. We'll talk about community. Okay, to me, that's great. I'm going to collectively put that as one. Who else? And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, how about you? Like, are you involved in this, right? And so that was like a light bulb moment for them to be like, oh, I've got to own some of this. Right. And when we think about healthcare more broadly, it's not just the patient, but a community that needs to own the outcomes. It's government, it is community organizations, it's legislation. All of these things go together, corporations and social good as well, to move the needle. If we want to say, you know, we've got the prevalence of diabetes is out of control, how do we fix that? It's not just give more insulin. It's not a just, oh, why can't they just go see more primary care docs? It's a, wait, are there food deserts? Are individuals having difficulty affording the food? Even if there is a whole food, whatever, you know, establishments there to provide healthy foods. So there's all these systemic barriers that are in the way that if we don't address those distributed actions, you're not really going to move the needle. And so we sit there and wonder, why can't this get better? It's because there's a lot of levers we got to pull, and it's got to be in sync. So my team's kind of focused on both of those elements, really thinking through how do we do good while also doing good for the company, that double bottom line. And so in public health, it's always a challenge because there's a cost involved for us to do the work, to do development, et cetera. But we're working down a path, and without getting too far into it and giving too much away, we're really looking at ways that we can leverage the data and the insights that we have to make it easier to do the two big concepts that I've talked about, whether it's through partnerships, whether it's through opportunities to help public health or politicians or whomever. Those are two big areas of focus. Another area that the team's also working on is, we call it clinical enablement, is how do we gain additional insights into what's happening? How do we understand that patient journey better with the information that we do have? You know, when I took care of patients, we talked about risk. Oh, you've got a 8% chance of something happening. You have 11% chance of a cardiovascular event in the next 10 years. That means I should start you on a drug. And that's typically what we were taught. What's the number needed to treat? I need to treat 50 people to see an outcome difference. So I'm going to do that. But we at Quest and kind of one of our other verticals, we were really working in a different paradigm where we're using predictions to say, no, this is the person you need to treat who's got a 90% chance of needing renal replacement therapy in the next 12 months, right? So that's a different, it sounds similar, but it's a different way to work because it's not a, oh, you've got a high percentage you're going to need dialysis. No, you're the one that's going to need it, not just a high percentage, right? So pointing that out changes how care navigation works, changes how we do things. And as we do more and more within our clinical enablement work, I think the stronger the predictions, the stronger the risk that we'll be able to identify and really get to a place where we'll know before maybe others what's likely to happen.
So when you have these types of conversations with clinicians, you know, are they understanding how and I don't want to call them algorithms per se, right? But, you know, you're using data and analyzing it in a way that's meaningful and providing other providers like actual actionable items. Is that something that they understand? Are they able to accept and resonate with that to say, well, this is going to help improve my outcomes and my practice, and that way I'll be able to take better care of, you know, the right patients? Or is there more conversation that stems from that, from an understanding perspective or even pushback?
So what I would say right now is that personally, I'm still working on refining that story, and I'm working towards it. And there's still challenges in individuals really grasping what this means. This hasn't really been taught in med school. This concept isn't a part of clinical practice. What's been taught is very different. And to really be here really requires different thinking that hasn't really been there. So there's a bit of a challenge, but again, an opportunity to really think about it differently. I remember having a conversation with a former colleague of mine around how do you determine who, as a clinician, has availability issues? And at that time, it was, well, the third next appointment. You find out how far away the third next appointment is, and that'll let you know if that number is really large, then their schedule swamped. If it's number small, then they've got availability coming up. I'm like, okay, that's one way, but what if we were to start predicting no-shows? What if we were to start leveraging other intelligence to say, wait, are they truly really busy or not? And in that conversation, that individual didn't grasp that concept. It was like, well, third next, that's the standard. That's what everybody does research on. And I'm like, that's fair, but what if we could change the paradigm? What if we could bring in new variables and new calculations and machine learning to be able to find a better way? What would that look like? And we never got there in that dialogue, but I think I've done that with other scenarios, and I think we have an opportunity to do that more broadly.
I'm excited for the future when you speak, Rehan, because I think that, you know, and I hate to say it, like, you know, it's like a generational difference, because there is an element to that, but I don't want to stereotype anyone and say, oh, I'm 52 and therefore I can't change. I am 52 and I can change. So I know that, you know, that would just be a stereotype that would be false. But I think it's important that when we look at the next generation of medical doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, pharmacists, optometrists, like, you know, we need this kind of education and dialogue in order to be able to make significant changes. And, you know, we both know how hard healthcare is in general, right? We talk about it. It's been talked about for decades, and we're talking about it as a provider. Forget that. I mean, the patients themselves are struggling day to day, and some, unfortunately, don't win the battle. So I think that this is really helpful in that space. You know, when you speak to others in the industry and you're having conversations with them about, you know, hey, how are you leveraging, you know, analytics and data in terms of what you do? Like, I'm sure that there's, you know, certain trends that you all see when you think about, well, this is how far we've come from where we were, which is great. You know, there's more work to be done, obviously, but there's something coming out of left field that we're starting to sense that this is going to be big, or maybe that this will be the next breakthrough. Like, how do you share or can you share with us in dialogue and conversations with others that are, you know, doing the work that you do about what healthcare should be prepared for in the next 2 or 3 years so that providers are more ready or more, at least more receptive to information and the way that they should act, rather than saying, oh, it's 2022, and now that we've come out of a pandemic, this is how we're going to operate. Because by the time we hit 2025, you know what? They just don't know.
And I would say, to some degree, I don't know if anybody truly knows, because we're all trying to advance it as fast as we can. To me, I go back to an example that I talk about around the finance industry. Today, if I were to ask you, Paul, when was the last time you deposited a paper check?
Like, literally, like going to the bank, signing it and giving it to the teller or ATM? 4 years, 5 years, maybe?
Okay, so have you done a paper check recently? Have you deposited one recently?
No. Maybe the past it's all digital.
Right, so yes, you have, but you've done it digitally, right?
Yes.
And so you did it through what? A little cell phone that you took a picture of on both sides.
Yes.
If in 2000 I told you, you know, you're going to take out this flip phone with this crappy camera take a picture of that check and it'll magically appear in your bank account. You won't even have to go in, and you can do it in your PJs. You would have thought I was crazy. You're like, what are you thinking? This?
Well, sure.
No, right?
Not this thing.
Or in 2000, you're going to push a button, a car with a random stranger is going to appear. You're going to get in the car and they'll take you wherever you want to go. And you don't even have to pay them because it'll come magically out of this device. Right? So there's these things that we can't even imagine in a period of time. And for me, I think that we're in that within healthcare. Healthcare, for me at least, has always lacked what technology and what implementation of technology has happened in other industries. If you look at retail today, you walk into a store, the cameras identify you as an individual, maybe not by name, but as an entity, and they can follow you throughout the store. Where you stood, where did you wait the longest, what part of the shelf did you look at? And they are able to then figure out, oh, where is there an opportunity to charge more for shelf pricing? Where should we move certain product to move it faster? All of that is around leveraging data to improve it. We don't do that in healthcare. What if we were to be like, oh, let's go ahead and look at patients moving around in clinic. Where do they get lost? Where do they stand a lot? Where are there opportunities to do patient education digitally? Right. So there's all these ways that we could bring those retail concepts or finance concepts into healthcare. And those are easier, quick wins today. But to get in, there's an investment. And then you run into, well, margins are 2%, 3%, depending upon which institution you're at. How do you invest those margins to get the biggest return? And that leads to a little bit of a lag, right? So there's, for me at least, all of this that's possible in the short term. Mm-hmm. Are we going to do it or not is really the big question. What we also see nowadays is biometrics are growing. There's a recent article that came out about a new AI voice recognition that can help detect depression. And so just by listening to your voice, it's able to detect changes in the way that you talk, that you might have depression creeping up or those symptoms coming on. So if we can do that, right, just by your voice, think about respiratory patterns. So if we could listen and be like, oh, it sounds like you're having some crackles or wheezing or other changes through voice. Or if you were to add a wearable and be able to track your heart rate, which I wonder if we've got wearables right now, right? Combine all of that, you could really start changing the paradigm around what kind of intervention, what understanding do we have? So I think all of that will come. When? I think it's probably in 2 or 3, but I think in the next 2 or 3 years, there's going to be a lot more data available. A lot of it's going to be around making sure it's clean, ready for use, and then really trying to understand, do we do this ourselves as an organization, meaning take the investment to hire people, build it out, or would it be smarter for us to partner with an organization that's already doing it and then just allow our data to feed through that? Into Quest does some of that, where we work with health systems and others to say, let us work with you. You don't have to build everything out yourself. We've already done the due diligence, we're working, and then we'll be that central entity to do all the development and work ahead. You as a health system can focus purely on getting value out of it, implementation, and what you're really good at. And so I think those are questions that institutions will have to decide. I think some larger ones will choose to develop. I think others will say, no, we think it's easier and more cost-effective to join that coalition.
I'm excited by it, but I'm also like so skeptical. And that's not you, Rehan, it's me, just because of my experiences, right? We see all these great ideas that come, you know, out of like these news articles and, you know, conferences and, you know, just anything that can be like possible gets done or is, you know, put out there with the hopes that someone, one individual, one entity can say, well, let's pilot this, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you mentioned biometrics, I'm like, so... I'm personally leery. Like my wife has, you know, went out and bought like, you know, an Apple Watch that like does that. My dad wanted one after he had an incident last year. And I'm all for that. Right. But I think that what I find interesting is how does one be able to like merge all that data, right? There's always this national database conversation, whatever side of the fence you're on, like that's irrelevant mm-hmm. for this conversation. What I think is important is, you know, how can we tap into both consumer behavior, patient care, and then like the provider perspective in order to be able to streamline it and educate people so they can say, hey, listen, I know you're a Doritos guy. You eat, you know, we know that you buy, you know, 2 bags a week. You live alone. alone, so obviously you're eating it. And obviously I'm, you know, being very vulnerable here and telling people what my diet looks like. But, you know, this is like where, you know, that kind of conversation might not register for a patient that says, well, I don't see the connection. And that's a great educational opportunity. And maybe that's what will happen. Who knows? But it is exciting to hear that. And I think that, you know, the way that you've structured your position as a partner is very enticing. I think that I hope that some of the listeners today, because we do have healthcare executives that look for ideas and opportunities, may want to reach out to you. So certainly we'll be able to share your contact information and you can guide them or communicate with them as well. You know, Rehan, we've talked a lot about Quest Diagnostics and about the work that you and your team do. I'd like to kind of dig in a little bit more about your professional journey. You know, you've had a very, you know, extensive career in many ways. Obviously, today you're the Chief Medical Informatics Officer and Senior Medical Director at Quest Diagnostics. Before that, you were a Director of Physician Executives at the Cerner Corporation. Before that, you were a Senior Director of Results Management at the Metro Health System in Cleveland. The list goes on and on. But I also know that within each opportunity that was presented to you, you know, it was an opportunity for you to let, you know, add and envision some new creative productions, like things that you could add to and says, well, here's an opportunity that they want me to take something that may already be in existence and elevate it, or to start from scratch. Talk to me a little bit about your decision-making process when this opportunity became available. Clearly, you were working in a different organization prior to this, and either through, you know, a connection or a conversation, or maybe just by happenstance, you saw this position, and, you know, it led you to ask questions, inquire, apply, and obviously you were presented an offer letter that you said, yes, let's do this. But it's never as black and white or as simple as it sounds. Tell me a little bit about what it is that enticed you to say yes to this opportunity. What were some concerns that you had prior to saying yes, and how did you work through them?
So I'm going to go further back prior to this opportunity and talk about my transition from being majority 90 plus percent frontline clinician to taking on more of a leadership role. There was a patient that I had taken care of whose son became a good friend, had been an entrepreneur and had several businesses in the region. And so as I would talk to him, just he would chat and become a good friend and a mentor. And when the opportunity came up to be the senior director at the county health system, Metro Health, he was like, let's go out to dinner and let's talk about this. So we were, and we went and ate and we talked, and I was contemplating, do I want to take this? Do I not? It's a big transition. It's a big shift. And the one question that Fred asked me that I still remember to this day is, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking I work in the ED. The worst that's going to happen is people die when I'm in the ED. If I don't get it right, somebody's coming in with a heart attack. If I don't get it right, that's their life. Like, I need to be on my game. I can't have any errors. This is a life or death situation. And that's the world that I had lived in. And so I'm like, well, the worst that's going to happen is I could lose my job. And he's like, yeah. And if that happened, what would you do? I'm like, I guess I'd have to go back and being a physician. He's like, wow, that sounds really bad. And I was like, now that you put it that way, I guess it's a risk worth taking, because it's, you know, it was a new opportunity, a completely big shift. And I said, you know, the way that you put it, then yeah, it's, yeah, the worst isn't really that bad. So let's go try it. And so I initially tried that, and it really was an eye-opening. I hadn't had the best mentors as leaders. And so what I replicated might not have been the ideal style. Fortunately, I had a great executive coach, Ron Fountain, who was the chairman of the board of the health system previously, who then joined as the VP for the division and continued to coach me. And with his help, I transformed not only as a leader, but the way that I thought about things and the way I approached things. And when it came to this opportunity, for me, it was twofold. One is, does it align to what I'm passionate about? And then is it aligned to my purpose of what I want to leave here? And it was a yes to both. And if that happens and you have an opportunity to join a great leader and culture, you say yes. And so that was a pretty easy decision at that point. Once I got to the understanding of what they were trying to accomplish and the culture of the team.
I think that that's a beautiful story, Rehan. And I'm glad you've had some strong influences in your life, right? The people that really just saw at things in you that they wanted to help develop and really help you see the world for what it is versus, you know, the perspective that we come in with, right? And I know exactly what you mean because, you know, if you make a mistake as a physician and a patient's life is in your hand, you know that the ultimate failure is the loss of life. But we tend to carry that forward, right? And no matter what we do, we just tend to think like, oh, very black and white. If it's failure, it's the worst thing in the world. When in reality, it's a step back. And that's pretty much about it. So I'm glad that you were able to hear these two individuals talk to you about that.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Rehan, we've talked about leadership quite a bit in the last few moments, and I'd like to kind of delve into that from that perspective, right? As a clinician, you're very aware of all of the guidelines that change on a regular basis. You're able to share that and apply that and teach others in that space. But leadership is not exactly, you know, part and parcel of a clinician's curriculum. You know, going through pharmacy school, you got business training to some degree, and that was an elective. And I don't believe that that's, you know, changed in the last 20 plus years, right? But when it comes to leadership, it's definitely a learned experience. And many people learn in different ways, mostly through failure, mostly through different lessons. But, you know, the lessons that we take from that are not always talked about and they're not always shared. So I'd love to understand a little bit about some of the lessons that you have learned as a leader, mostly probably through failure, through trial and error, that you think are undervalued or that you think are underemphasized in the greater world that we live in today.
So I'm a guest lecturer for a few universities, and I've done this lecture for the Weatherhead School of Management at Case several times where I'm asked to come in and talk, and I spend about an hour and a half talking about my failures. And it's kind of the opposite of what the students typically get from other leaders who come in and talk about all that they've accomplished. So failures is something that, unfortunately, I've got a lot of experience with, but it's getting through the failures and overcoming and learning and growing, I think, is the biggest part of all of this. When it comes to leadership style, there's been influences of both types, both good and bad. Bad to learn what not to do. Good, obviously, is to what to do. And then others wanting to be a good mentor, but maybe not always saying the right thing. I remember, again, early on as I transitioned into more of a leadership role, certain clinicians would come up to me and say, don't ever forget your white coat. Always wear your white coat. You're a physician. Don't ever forget that. And in my head, I was like, I'm a physician for sure. That's one of my roles, but that doesn't fully define me as a person. And that is something that not everybody is able to delineate their career, their profession that they're doing at that time versus who they are. Many times people get lost in that. And being able to step back, I think, is an important part of being a leader and understanding that there's a human component, there's a person component, and then there are skills that they have. And while they're demonstrating a certain skill and a certain task, aka a physician or a pharmacist or a nurse, that may or may not be all of the skills that they have. And so once you understand that, then you start reflecting on yourself and like, well, what are the other skills that I have? Where are there opportunities for me to improve? And from a leadership perspective, what I like most is the ability to work with really talented individuals and helping them become the best version of themselves. And seeing individuals do that and have them accomplish things that they themselves thought they couldn't do, and then afterwards appreciating it, you're like, it's a really good feeling to see that. I remember in my last role, I had a phenomenal leader. She was having a meeting with the national leadership of the VA, and she was saying, you know, there's going to be national leaders there. You should probably be there as my boss. Because they're going to be there. I'm like, but you're my leader for all of this. Like, why do you need me there? She's like, well, because there, you know, some big names are going to be there. She should be there. I'm like, well, do you need me there? Or do you just want me there as a name thing? And she's like, well, I don't like really need you there. I think I can handle it. I'm like, okay, well then if you think you can handle it, then I trust you. What can I do to help you prepare? What can I do to make sure you're comfortable and ready to go? But I don't need to take that limelight away from you. You're my leader. In essence, they're going to come to you. And she went ahead. Things went phenomenally well, built great trust with the organization, and just knocked it out of the park. And getting to do that, and that's just one of many examples, that's what I think leadership is about. It is not about management. It's not about, let me see your time card. It's not about, where were you? Those are things that sometimes you have to do for an individual who might not be performing or isn't really participating or engaged. And you're wondering, well, why is that happening? Is this not your role? Is this not what you're interested in? If so, let's figure that out. Or maybe this is not your opportunity for you. But ideally, the focus really is, what makes you happy? What gets you excited? Let me help you determine your own passion. And then how do I support that? How do I grow that? And how do I get you to do things you yourself thought you couldn't do? And then at the end of the day, we're all going to win, right? We're all going to make contributions that are far greater than what we thought we could do individually. And, you know, from a leadership perspective, we can talk about servant leadership. We could talk about resiliency. We can talk about gratitude. We can talk about mindfulness. There's a lot of different concepts that were never taught in med school. I still remember our behavioral health lessons, which was, you feel blank because, right? So when you talk to a patient, they're telling you sad, and you hear all of this, you're supposed to respond with, you feel blank because. And those type of bucketed stuff was the extent of what we got, you could argue might be a translate into leadership. Or maybe when you're on the wards having to work with the other teams, whether it's nurses, respiratory therapists, you name it, to make sure you're coordinating efforts for the patient, that might be a sense of leadership that you learn on the job, but really nothing formal. There wasn't this sense of, hey, you're going to be looked at in a certain way, make sure you're carrying yourself in a certain manner, understand your words carry a lot of weight, so be really mindful, make sure you work on, you know, the three elements of executive presence, talking about crucial, like all these concepts weren't, it's not there. And so there's two other ones that I personally think are really important. And I'll end with that, which is, one is storytelling. We're doing that here today. I'm telling stories. You're telling stories. You're doing these on all of these podcasts. But when you think about leaders, those that are really inspirational, they're really good at telling stories. They get your emotions. They get you bought in. They're like, oh, I want, yeah, whatever that person is selling, I want that. And the selling is the other one. And we're all selling every day. When I was a clinician taking care of a patient, I was selling my treatment plan in convincing the patient, this is the right thing for you. Here's why you're not feeling well. This is the diagnosis. This drug will help treat this. And this is what will happen. And you should do this. And if I didn't do a good job selling, they wouldn't take the medication and they'd be back again and there'd be no improvement. So sales and storytelling, I think, are two really underrated skills that we need more of.
Rehan, how can somebody build those two skill sets, storytelling and selling? And I'm going to start by saying, you know, there's going to be a percentage of listeners that, you know, who are clinicians or providers that seem to gravitate towards the notion that, listen, we don't sell, right? Like we are, you know, science-based professionals, and, you know, it's right there, black and white on the wall. You know, if you have A, then therefore the solution is B. I should not have to, you know, influence you to be able to do that. Like, that's why you come to me. Like, there's always going to be that percentage, and that's fine. If that's who you are, that's great. And this is not for you. But for those that are like understanding the concepts that we're talking about, which is, you know, I need to be able to have my patients buy in into this process, and I'm just not good at it. Like, how, you know, they may spend the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years going through these scenarios of trial and error and going, okay, I can't say that again next time. But is there a way to shorten that curve? Are there tools, programs, ways that you can suggest to the listeners that says, look, If you want to be a better storyteller, here's where you should start. Or if you want to learn sales in the sense of being able to sell your ideas and your notions, this is where I would recommend you go.
So my sales experience started when I was 16. I initially worked at Best Buy in the Geek Squad arena. It wasn't called the Geek Squad then. It was just the tech area. And then I transitioned out into sales. So initially I was selling computers, stuff that I knew. But soon we had a shortage in the appliances arena. And so they're like, hey, you're doing pretty good in computers. Let's put you in appliances. So you had a 16-year-old kid who had never done laundry in his life, never cooked a meal, yet selling washers and dryers to grandparents and getting them to believe that I'm going to help them make the right recommendation. Right. So that's what I had to figure out. And in that window, I had to learn very quickly how to identify the needs of our customer and what does that customer want to accomplish. And so I would ask questions about, oh, what all do you wash at home? Do you have big comforters? Do you have big blankets? You like to do one large load, or are you okay with smaller loads? Right. Really getting into types of questions that I've never done a load of laundry at that time. Like I was like, I don't know, my mom takes care of that for me, right? But I had to ask those questions and learn that. And then to be able to work through and understand the requirements, the needs of the customer at the time. And it's no different in healthcare. You know, when I'm seeing my patient, I'm really trying to figure out what are they trying to accomplish with their life? Oh, I want to be able to go to my grandson's graduation or make sure I can walk him down the aisle, or there's this trip coming up that's really important to me. Okay, let's work on that. I remember having a patient with ED who was a erectile dysfunction, who was a severely uncontrolled diabetic. And prior to me, he had seen another provider and we would get, Viagra on a regular basis. And when he saw me, I was like, you know, we really have to get your diabetes under control. He's like, why? Can I just have my pills and go? And I'm like, well, you do realize there's microvascular complications from this uncontrolled diabetes that actually could be the reason you're needing this other drug. And sitting down and helping him realize, whoa, wait, if I control this, this other thing will get better for me too? Huh. Okay, I'll hear you out, but can I still have my pills? I'm like, well, how about we do this? You get this under control for me, and if you still need it, we'll go ahead and get it for you. All right, I'm willing to try that with you, doc. Got it under control, didn't need his meds as much, right? So working through that with the patient was really important. Was that a sale or was that really sharing information? I don't know. I consider that selling. Others might be like, well, I just told them the facts. But the facts and how you share the facts makes a big difference. Think about smoking. What are we taught in med school about smoking? It's really bad. It's going to cause cancer. Why are you still doing it? You should quit now. It's a ton of money. What's wrong with you? How well has that worked? Like, it really doesn't, right? And we don't really do the positive psychology behind it. Well, what are you trying to accomplish? When do you smoke? Why do you smoke? Let me help you understand that. Oh, you do it when you're anxious. What else happens when you're anxious? Let's really talk. Well, what would that be like if you weren't anxious? What would that be? Would you still do that? Oh, I probably, okay. Let's really figure out what you want with your life. Again, what's the value I can add, right? Bringing your life to where you want it. Then how do I get there is the rest of me. And so understanding where the patient is or the customer or whomever you're working with, try to understand what they want to accomplish, what that gap is, and how can I help them fulfill that gap?
Rehan, when you speak to young students, right, or even like new practitioners, like you said that you are a guest lecturer at a university, so you have an opportunity to impart knowledge, but at the same time, you know that a percentage of those students are going to move on into a leadership role, and some of them are very, you know, quick to adapt and embrace them. Using today's concepts and today's understanding of where the world is, right? But there are future challenges that maybe are not even on their horizon, or they're not even thinking about this as, wow, I wasn't prepared. Like, if there's somebody that's listening today, like, what would you say is a challenge that future leaders need to start preparing themselves for now, so when they are in that role, they're better equipped to manage or handle them?
Yeah, it's a challenging question. I think there's unfortunately a lot. I think the expectations around what a work environment should look like is changing. And we've seen that. What we've also seen is what workers are expecting around a living wage and how they want to be treated. we're hearing elements of there's a worker shortage. And I would argue there isn't a worker shortage. There is a shortage of jobs that pay well enough to attract the workers. And so there's going to be a lot more of trying to understand what does value look like for the employee? Why should I be here? Why should I stick around if I can make $4, $5, $6, $10 an hour more somewhere else? There's a certain point where money doesn't matter as much, but up to that point, it does. And, you know, so depending upon where this leader is working in healthcare for most clinicians, money is less of an issue because you're beyond that point. And, you know, the study that I looked at, this was a while ago, and says number for inflation is probably higher, but at that time is around 80,000, around 80,000 or more. Once you can cover your basic expenses, your living, and you're comfortable, anything beyond that, while still beneficial, doesn't carry as much weight as other things. And that gets into recognition, what your work environment is, what your team is like, what's the culture. And so it's going to be really important for these leaders to think about that holistically. And the more that they're able to think through what type of culture do I want to build? Do I want to build something where it is collaborative, where we all come to work smiling and happy and we have fun while we're still tackling challenging things, making sure we keep things flexible so that way employees can actually live their life and not feel like they're stuck. One of my team members today, he actually worked with me in a prior company. And when I had an opening, he was like, can I apply? And I was like, I didn't think you'd want to work with me again, but sure, come on. And so he applied and went through and he's with, but, we're a fully remote team and I care less about where you are. I care more about what gets done. And so he's taken this opportunity to travel. And so sometimes he's in one city and then sometimes he's in another city. And we all joke, where in the world is he at this point? And it's great for him. He gets that flexibility to travel. He does phenomenal work. It's really hard, dedicated, always there when needed. But that flexibility is important to him. Could he make more? Probably could. But he is here because of the culture, the team. He knows I have his back. I will support and mentor. I've got others who are in a similar boat where they could make more if they were to leave, but they know that the mission, the vision, the purpose of what they're doing here makes it worthwhile staying. And I think that those types of attractors are going to be really important in the future. If we forget why we're doing this, we're going to be lost and people are going to burn out and people are going to really focus on, oh, I can make a couple of dollars more, I'm going to go. Thanks, bye.
I think that's the first time anyone's been as blunt with that information, but it's so valuable, right? We hear and see a lot, especially coming from a talent acquisition perspective. We talk about employer value propositions, and we talk about, you know, how to help, you know, our current existing employees understand, you know, all the benefits that exist, but sometimes we actually have to help them make that connection, right? Because there is an instinctual desire to make more money. You can make 80 and then suddenly you have an opportunity that's 85 and you're like, oh, you know what? Obviously this is the better job, but what are you sacrificing in that transition, right? Are you suddenly now going from a 40-hour week to a 60-hour week? Well, then is it really worth it? You know, are you like, you know, is there any separation for you in terms of work-life integration? Are you comfortable with that? Like, do you have flexibility to suddenly take your mom, dad, or child to a doctor's office without having to be micromanaged? And, you know, those things come to fruition 2-3 months later after a decision has been made. And then it's dangerous and deleterious for both employer and employee. So I'm glad that you said that, Rehan. And that's I hope that people really take stock in that. And before they, you know, even consider something like, what's important to me? How do I prioritize that? And then what are the value, you know, propositions that are being created in this opportunity now versus one that I'm looking forward to moving into as well. Rehan, you know, you are such an amazing guest. I really am enjoying this conversation. A lot of your experiences and the way that you see things are basically have been shaped through the experiences that you've had. And as a leader, you know, you try to impart that knowledge to your team, specifically the people that you're managing. But you know, there are those that will want to be able to leverage other resources that they can feel as if it's tangible, something they can consume. Is there a book, a video, maybe a speaker or an author that you tend to recommend more often to others, either on your team or through mentees, where you think, you know, when I was young, I saw this, I read this, or I came across this and it really made an impact for me. And I think you should check it out. Something that you would recommend to the listeners of today's podcast as well.
So there's several. From a inspiration perspective, Simon Sinek, I've read a lot of his books, watched a lot of his talks, The Golden Circle, focusing on why, understanding your purpose, why are you here, what are you doing, have all resonated with me. The seeking out of purpose for me happened in med school, as I went through a lot of negative experiences or trauma, as people would call it. And that allowed me to overcome it. And so in my career, as I found various books and authors and inspirational individuals, Simon kind of stood out. It reminded me of what I had to go through to be able to continue. And I would encourage people to read him and his books. There are several others. We've got Brian Tracy and Zig Ziglar, both talk about sales and talking about value and how do you have those conversations. Caldini talks about influence, which is really important in what we do. There's a difference between manipulation and influence, and we've got to understand sometimes it's a fine line. But I want to influence people. I don't want to manage people. I want to help people become the best version of themselves through influence, not because I micromanage or do any of those other pieces. And then I'd also add Robert Tuft, when it comes to visualization of data, or Presentation Zen, which is a website that, again, both of them talk about how do we present information in a way so it's consumed easier or better. All that gets back to storytelling, but most of the corporate world really relies on PowerPoint or presentations. And so if you can do that in an effective manner, less words, more ideas, getting executives to really grasp what you want them to grasp quickly, it makes it easier for you to advance your ideas.
I'm going to have to check that one out. You said by Tufts, what was it called again?
He has several books that talk about visualization of data. There's four different books that get into the weeds about data visualization of this type of data. You should consider this type of graph and how you might want to get into it. I would say you can get into the weeds. For me, it was good to read and understand concepts, and I take concepts forward and really adapt them to me. How do I want to incorporate concepts rather than thinking of them as rules, which for me isn't as fun because I like to still be creative. I'm still, you know, building as I go, and that entrepreneurial side wants to innovate and take lessons from others, but still find ways to improve.
Excellent. That's fantastic. Rehan, as you look at your team, and I'm sure that like most organizations, right, we talked about a talent shortage or, you know, talent challenges and the talent drought. However, whatever phrase that's being used nowadays, right? Talent is priority number one for almost every company, especially in healthcare, but for many organizations, regardless of industry. And when you think about people that do show up and that do apply and that meet minimum qualifications and get to you, you know, you're looking for certain qualities that obviously were talked about in a resume or CV, but now they're standing in front of you and you're having to reconcile what they said that they were and what they really are showing you. And this can be a great opportunity for you to find that diamond in the rough where you're like, you know, this person may not have 100, you know, may not check off every single box, but they're presenting A, B, and C. And that is exactly the qualities and characteristics I want in my next associate. Or maybe you're looking at people on your team today. You mentioned, you know, an individual that was one of your leaders that was representing. And you're like, how did you know that this person was like completely capable? And when you look at your team today, like you are already at the next level. You are now just stuck in this current position. It's time for you to move forward. And that's what leaders do. What are those three qualities or characteristics that you look for in a prospective hire or for a person that you'd want to promote into a higher level role?
For me, there's a few things. I look at the individual's desire. Is it aligned to their passion? Is this something that they really want to do? Is this what they're going to get up every Monday morning being excited about? If they're not going to be excited about it every Monday morning, then this might not be what's really their passion. I want to help people be the best version, not be their motivator every day, right? I need people to have like their own self-interest in the work that we do. And if they don't have that, then maybe this isn't the right fit. Then there's the ability piece. Do they have the contextual knowledge to do this? If you don't, but you still have a desire, is that something that I can train you? Is that something I can teach you? Is that an investment I can make to cover that gap? And if I can, that might be a risk I'm willing to take. And then finally, what's their personality or their fit, or how well are they going to fit into this culture that we're trying to build? At least within our division, we've got a very diverse culture. We've got people all of different religions, races, ethnicities, and we celebrate that. And so wanting to make sure that individuals joining in are going to celebrate that as well is going to be an important piece of this. And so, you know, there's a few different hires that I've had in my career. And, you know, there's been some who have been very green, but we're like, you know what, this person I think can do it. And we all agree that if we support this individual, they will do phenomenally well. And so far, those bets, for the most part, always work out, right? There's exceptions here and there to every though, but, you know, I'm going to talk about my successes, less than my failures right now. But we've had some phenomenal people. We recently started an internship program where one of my team members I promoted into a leadership capacity. He had a great idea to think about building a talent pipeline and said, what if we did an internship program? And so we got that put together and supported. We put that out there. Guess how many applicants we had for this? We're looking for master students or soon to be master students. You're in talent acquisition. What do you think?
How recently was it put out?
This was put out probably in May of this year.
I'm hoping it's double digits.
We had over 800.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Phenomenal turnout of applicants. And we had individuals from Ivy League to individuals who actually were teaching physicians at one point because of their role, because really? They were a grad teacher, right? So people in tons of skills coming on board, many of which who had phenomenal portfolios that they were sharing of, we've already done what you're wanting the interns to do, and I'd love to join you on this. So getting them excited was great when they met to see how inspired this next generation is so exciting and uplifting of the students. And so far they've all done phenomenally well, and they're all working on elements that they're aligned to their own passion and their purpose. And that was my big part of my interview, is trying to understand, well, why do you want to do this, right? You're really smart. You could go make more money somewhere else. Why do you want to be here? And so in those conversations, those that stood out have joined, and they've done phenomenally well. So again, people are there who are wanting jobs. It's, do you provide them something of value? And it's not before where people are struggling, oh, I have to get a job. It's now, what job do I want? And what's going to make me happy? And so there are definitely ways that every job can do things to make it better. And that's on the leadership, right? It's not on the employees to figure that out. It's on leaders to figure out how do they make it better.
That's phenomenal. 800 applications. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Congratulations, man. That's just that in it alone, in and of itself, is mind blowing.
Yeah.
So that's, wow. That's going to take me a second or two to remember from that. That doesn't happen, Rehan. It just doesn't happen. It's, I know. Yeah, right. I'm just still like,
boy. We were anyway. Really worried as we were going through this. We're like, you know, this is a really tough program. Data scientists typically don't want to be in healthcare. They want to be in finance where there's a ton of money. Are we even going to get anybody to apply? And so fortunately, I promoted it through my own network. A few of my colleagues did as well. And it just blew up, and people saw what we were doing and the potential. And in conversations with the leader over the area, Justin, and then with me, I think it was just, this this makes sense. And so we've been fortunate.
Very good. Well, congratulations. And hopefully you found, like, you know, all of the right people. And now you still have leftovers, right? You still have applications that were there was still, you know, a good talent pool now that we have left. Rehan, what do you see for yourself over the next 18 months when you think about a professional goal that you are working to achieve? You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, you're doing right now at Quest Diagnostics, both, you know, within your team as also an individual. But what have you sort of set your sights on where if we were to come back and have a follow-up call or a follow-up episode in 2024, that you would say, you know, Iqbal, I remember telling you that this is what I wanted to do. And now I get to tell you I've done it. And here's what it looks like. What is that goal for you?
You know, my long-term goals are to continue to grow. You know, there's, I remember when I got the senior director role at Metro, which was several roles prior, I had talked to others and they were like, oh, so you've made it. And I'm like, what do you mean you've made it? Like, oh, you're senior director. You're part of the senior leadership team at a county hospital. You've got a pension. You're fine. You're good. And I'm like, what are you trying to apply? He's like, you've made it. You don't really have to try much. You just kind of stick around and you'll be okay. And I'm like, actually, I'm just getting started. Like, this isn't a made it moment. Like, I'm going to continue to work and I'm going to continue to excel. I'm going to continue to grow. And so if you were just come back to me in, you know, 18 months, I'm hoping that I'll be a better leader than I am today. I'm hoping I'll have a larger team than I have today. And I've got a team that's able to do more than I have today. And I'll continue to have accomplishments where we can sit and tell you, these are all the things that people thought we couldn't do. And we found a way to do it. And I've luckily got lots of stories, both clinical and non-clinical, where people thought it couldn't be done. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get it done. Is it luck? Maybe. Do I have, you know, my grandmother and my mom praying for me and that's why it's happening? Maybe. Is it, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's thing in who you are, what the reason is, we can all talk about, but I've been very fortunate and blessed to be able to really accomplish at times what has felt to be impossible. And as long as I'm able to continue to do that and add more stories to that and continue to grow and have a bigger influence both within my team, but also more broadly in public, I think I'll be considered, in my head at least, that I've been successful.
Rehan, you've been an incredible guest. I really want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show, for sharing us with your story and really helping us understand, you know, the value adds that you've been able to experience and bring to the audience today. I know that there's going to be more opportunities where you and I will connect, but, you know, again, just your insights today and the experiences, I think, are going to leave the audience that's listening to this episode in a much better position. And as always, I wish you nothing but the best. And I look forward to seeing you continue to take healthcare to a higher level.
Thank you so much, Iqbal, for the pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Healthcare and Higher podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow and subscribe for more. I'm your host, Iqbal Acha, and I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what you thought about this episode or my show in general. Also, visit me at www.achainternational.com to learn more about how I help healthcare professionals and healthcare leaders advance their career, build a better brand, and create a leadership legacy. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, let's keep working to take healthcare to a higher level.